Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is United States against Harrison. Mr. Goldberger.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Goldberger. It's my privilege this morning to represent Maurice Harrison, who is the appellant here and was the defendant below. It's good to see you again. Mr. Harrison testified at a jury trial, and we've raised one trial-related issue. I'm speculating that the court may wish primarily to discuss the evolving standards for plain error under the Booker decision, but if I may just a moment.
You may find that since the court has been hearing Booker cases mm-hmm. more or less continuously for 2 weeks,
yes.
And has been devoting most of its waking and sleeping hours to Booker issues, unless you have something that's quite new to say about the subject, you may find that it's ground that's already traversed.
That's hard.
Bench and bar may expect to hear from us shortly on that question.
Yes. It's hard for me to know what you've heard in the last 2 weeks since I haven't been here, but I'll...
If there's anything we haven't heard in the last 2 weeks, it will be a surprise.
I'm sure you'll let me know. the legal question with respect to the trial issue is this. Does there come a time when a series and sequence of objections, even when lodged in good faith and some of them validly, interferes with the defendant's right to testify to the point where the trial judge ought to control and put a stop to it?
And here's my issue with that. There were, I think, 300 questions asked, and there were only 18 objections made. So how can that number of objections really overwhelm the defense case and not permit the defense case to go in? That's where I'm, you know, I could see half of the questions were objected to or three-quarters of the questions, but mm-hmm. 18 out of 300?
Well, we looked at that. The government made that point in their brief, and we looked at it and thought about it in terms of the reply brief. And our response is this, that the actual total length and amount of testimony is actually rather short. There were 300 questions because the questions were rather short and clipped and precise. But if you look at it in terms of transcript pages, the whole transcript of the direct testimony is about 40 pages. 18 objections is about one every two pages, that is, one every couple of minutes. Some of them in groups that are more than one a minute when you experiment, as I did, with reading it out loud and keeping an eye on the watch. And since there were no objections during many pages of lead-up in which the defendant was permitted to introduce himself and say how old he was and where he lived and that kind of thing, it's a little misleading to look at the total number of questions.
Most of the objections were sustained, were they not?
About half. Most of them were sustained. My analysis, again, in the reply brief was of the 18, it was 8 and 10 of 6 were overruled. 2, we say, were improperly sustained, making it about half and half.
Right. Plus, you're not quarreling that the objections were not made in good faith.
That's right. That's right. I'm not arguing for a subjective standard of bad faith by the prosecutor. If there were one, of course.
What is your argument? So what is your argument? Are you saying that a district judge should turn to the prosecutor and say, I will not allow more than one objection every 3 minutes?
No, there wouldn't be any mechanical rule. It would have to be a subjective reaction by the judge to the effect of the pattern of objections on the defendant's actual testimony in that case. I couldn't possibly propose a mechanical rule.
So would you be suggesting then when there are valid objections that the prosecutor has, that the prosecutor hold those objections for a period of time before they're made? I don't even see mm-hmm. how this could, if they're legitimate objections,
I think
the prosecutor has a duty to make those objections.
I think that can be overstated.
Certainly if there's also an issue of could the questions be framed better by defense counsel? And that would be a way to avoid objections.
That's right. But when the objection is to the form of the question, when it's the objection, as many of these objections were to harmless leading, but it was leading. It's completely in the discretion of the judge. It's not resulting in the admission of improper testimony. It's not prejudicial to the other party. Trial lawyers do refrain from making probably most of their valid objections most of the time for reasons of their own. And I'm suggesting there that in this respect, the defendant's ability to present his testimony was hampered. And he did prevail on the first count. And so if there was error, it certainly couldn't have been harmless. If it was constitutional in nature, it certainly couldn't have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, since the jury's assessment of this defendant's credibility and personality was the key to the verdict on an entrapment case.
But on the other hand, you can look at the acquittal as saying that any error that occurred was harmless.
Well,
you know, because otherwise,
I understand.
If this so poisoned the defense case and was so prejudicial, the jury could have convicted on both counts.
Well, I think, again, in our reply brief, we did an analysis of the part of the testimony that related to count two. That is, what you have with an entrapment here is, was he predisposed before the first sale? Does the evidence of the first sale suggest that by the time of the second sale, he was then, in the jury's view, sufficiently predisposed to disqualify him from an entrapment defense? So I think it's fair to look at the time frame separately, and there is quite a concentration of these objections in that piece of the testimony. So that's the way we broke it down, and that's my answer to that question.
All right. Thank you.
All right. With respect to the sentencing, the principal challenge enhancement was the two-level enhancement for obstruction of justice. It ties right into what we were just talking about. It related the judge's finding, Judge Conlon's finding, that the defendant committed perjury in his testimony which the jury credited with respect to count one, apparently, although, of course, we never know exactly, and not with respect to count two. The judge gave... Normally, this would be essentially beyond appellate scrutiny, the judge said, based on the entire reaction to the judge's testimony, putting aside the Booker question, the constitutional question for a moment, that the judge found it to be material, false, obstruction of justice to the point of meeting the Dunnigan perjury standard. Here the judge gave two specific reasons, made two specific findings and gave two specific reasons, neither of which holds up to fairness and logic. The first was the defendant knew someone from whom the drugs could be obtained, presumably after being badgered to the point where the jury found him to have been entrapped. And we say that this is based on a presumption that a person not involved with drugs would not know who the drug dealers were in a neighborhood where somebody grew up and knew everybody. In fact, the person that he said he knew had access to the drugs was someone for whom he had worked as an auto mechanic. If that person was also selling drugs or had turned to selling drugs, it's something the defendant would know without being a drug dealer himself, and thus it wouldn't prove or tend to prove the perjury. Likewise, the defendant's use of drug...
It's an argument one can make to the judge, but mm-hmm. why is it an argument that a judge must believe? You're articulating,
I don't know, it's a question
a reason
of belief.
Why yes. you would make a particular line of argument to a judge. You're not articulating a reason why the judge's finding is legally impossible.
That it is not logical. The inference the judge drew from the undisputed fact is not a logical one. I don't think that's a matter of just believing it or not believing it. A finding that the judge makes which does not logically follow from the evidence that the judge cites is not a credibility finding, seems to me. When you coupled in particular also with the second part.
Have you read Anderson against City of Bessemer City recently?
I certainly read it. I don't know what counts as recently. I don't do a lot of civil summary judgment.
It's the same standard.
But I understand.
It has to do with the standard of appellate review when the judge says, I disbelieve the following testimony and conclude that you were lying.
Yes. Even when based on documents, I believe, is what was the disputed question there. Yes.
The court's holding was that such a finding can be set aside essentially only if it is physically impossible, if it's contrary to the laws of nature, if it's contrary to unimpeachable other evidence, right? If there were documents showing that this person was shaking hands with the president in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
when the judge finds he was someplace else. Short of that, nothing an appellate court does.
Well, I'm suggesting that it isn't short of that, that there's nothing the court can do, because if the court says, I don't believe you because I noticed you are left-handed, when it simply doesn't follow in any way, a credibility doesn't follow from the observation that the judge made. There is no basis in fact for the premise on which the conclusion is being drawn. The same is true with respect to the drug jargon, which is the second basis that the judge gave. The judge said, defendant used drug slang in these conversations. A person wouldn't know that drug slang unless the person was a drug dealer. I'm saying that is just not a fact in America. People do know drug slang. They know it from having gone to high school. They know it from listening to music on the radio. They know it from watching TV. It is an assumption. It's a cultural assumption coming from the judge's own milieu, perhaps, but it is not true of this defendant in this neighborhood. There is no basis to believe it is true that a person would not know these words and the meaning of these words. It wasn't a code, as the prosecutor suggested, which would certainly support the inference, a private code, that is, between the seller and buyer. It was jargon, and I showed in the reply brief, I cited the various websites or anti-drug websites, including the White House Office of Drug Control, that listed all the words that the judge cited as being drug jargon slang, that is nationally recognized slang for certain terms. If that finding was erroneous, then numerous adjustments fall, because each of them is predicated on it, that is, the acceptance and the safety valve as well. The acceptance of responsibility adjustment is particularly interesting in entrapment cases, because there is authority in this court, which the government just doesn't cite, even though we relied on it principally, that a person who presents an entrapment defense may very well be accepting responsibility within the meaning of that rule. So I think I would finish, if I had peril, at my own peril, by mentioning where I see Booker coming into play here. Booker error can be either constitutional or non-constitutional, I would suggest. It says clearly at the end of Justice Breyer's opinion, there is or isn't a Sixth Amendment violation. There is, in this case, a Sixth Amendment violation that is an enhancement treated as mandatory, rather than the case where there was no enhancement treated as mandatory, but the guidelines as a whole were treated as mandatory anyway, the non-constitutional violation. Here there was a constitutional violation. The violation, we meet our burden on the, if we have any burden to show it concretely on the record, a real possibility or a reasonable doubt, if you will, if it's a constitutional error standard, burden shifts to the defendant. What we have to
Are
show
you
is
saying there's constitutional
yes.
error there, even though the jury found the defendant guilty and therefore presumably found that he was lying.
Yes. I don't think the jury has to find, it's not a finding that the defendant lied with the intent of obstructing justice and the elements of perjury. The jury's finding of guilt on the crime does not say
that.
Well,
it may not always be, but isn't it in this case, it's pretty hard to justify the verdict without a determination that the defendant was lying, isn't it?
Well, the jury could also have readily found that what the defendant described didn't rise to the level of inducement, even believing everything he said, that a law-abiding person wouldn't be induced by that kind of importuning. And that would be a jury judgment that wouldn't require a finding of perjury. And I think there is... it is unclear in the law now, and it's certainly in dispute among all the other circuits that I've been following, whether the burden in a plain error situation is on the defendant to show the existence of a reasonable doubt that the verdict may have been different, to show which I infer from
it's
Cotton.
Not anything to do with the verdict.
I'm sorry, not the verdict. I beg your pardon. Thank you. That the sentence would have been different. Thank you. Or to show a substantial a substantial probability, but a real probability, the sort of the non-constitutional standard of a different verdict. Here we have it. We have the judge commenting on the severity of the guidelines. We have the judge giving the bottom of the guideline range. This is a case that ought to be vacated and remanded for consideration of sentencing under the rubric of Section 3553A, considering all the factors in the judge's discretion, either down to the level of the mandatory minimum if it doesn't fall from the safety valve, or potentially below if it does. I yield the rest of my time if there aren't further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberger.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Barnes.
May it please the Court. James Barnes on behalf of the United States. Address the trial issues that counsel has raised. First, two things with regard to counsel's argument. First, the idea that the objections that were properly sustained could somehow form the basis of a constitutional violation, there's absolutely no law to support that argument. It would sort of handcuff the prosecutor that after he's used up his however many objections, say 10, he would have to sit there helplessly while improper evidence was then introduced before the jury. Secondly, with regard to his argument, there's not any part of the defense that he is indicated was kept out through these objections. It's pretty clear if you read it, and I was there, I remember it. He was laying the foundation for some conversations. We objected because he hadn't laid a foundation. He went right into them. He laid them, and then he brought out everything he wanted to bring out to support his entrapment defense. So there was nothing kept out from the jury based on the objections. Turning next to the sentencing, the district court made all the findings. The district court observed the individual's testimony, heard the tapes, heard what we argued was drug code, and agreed that any individual who had not previously sold drugs could not understand that conversation.
Well, what about his argument that the words are part of the culture, that these words are on music videos and CDs and that kind of thing, and so it could just be part of, quote, national drug slang?
Well, it's an argument. It's not an argument that was supported by the record. I don't believe there was anything in the record at the time to suggest that. I don't believe that was... I may be mistaken, but
there's nothing in the record one way or the other, is there, in this point?
Well, the record is that the defendant received a phone call and was asked for how much the Cadillac was going to cost, and said it was going to, you know, they were going to go around 63rd. It was going to be the hard way, hard meaning crack cocaine. And he admitted this. The defendant admitted that these were terms, hard way meant crack cocaine. And the district court did not believe, and I don't think that...
Well, he used all this lingo, but the issue is, would he have known it if he hadn't been a drug dealer, isn't it? Well, I don't know that there's anything in the record on that point, is it?
Well, exactly. There is nothing in the record to suggest that he would have known what these terms meant, but for his experience as a drug dealer. We called a witness in rebuttal who indicated that he had bought 63 grams of crack cocaine on multiple occasions from the defendant. And I don't think there was anything to suggest the district court was required or even asked to take judicial notice that those terms are commonly known to any individual on the street or from any particular community for that matter, and that they could have been understood in any context outside of the drug context. There was a second reason, though, that the district court also found he obstructed. There was a second lie. And the second lie was that he had engaged in prior conversations with the informant to set up that drug deal. And the district court found that based upon a review of that tape where they set up the price, the quantity, the type of drug, that indicated that, in fact, there had been no prior discussions where those items had been discussed and agreed upon. And so for all those reasons and the reasons set forth in our brief, we respectfully request that the sentence be affirmed.
Well, let me just point, getting back again to this language, you say that in your brief the language caught on tape is more in the nature of code than commonly recognized drug slang. So you acknowledge that there is commonly recognized drug slang. And the counsel pointed out you can find that even on the government's webpage, a lot of these terms.
I would acknowledge that.
I'm trying to understand what the difference is.
In the drug world, there is, you know, certain common types of slang that's used to refer to drugs. I guess, and if my appellate brief is less than clear on this, I guess what I'm not acknowledging is that it's common in culture in general, and that an average person, if you could walk up Michigan Avenue or any street for that matter and ask them what a Cadillac was on 63rd Street the hard way, that they would say, oh, you're talking about crack, 63 grams of crack cocaine as opposed to powder cocaine, which would be the soft way.
This sale took place, not Michigan Avenue.
No, but Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that I don't think there's any community that you could say that would be generally recognized by any citizen on the street other than perhaps, you know, the drug dealers.
So you just haven't been to certain areas in the city? I just think that's a very naive statement. Living here in the city of Chicago, knowing the number of cases we've had where there are whole drug operations set up where people are selling drugs, you know, on street corners, just like the Shell gas station.
Is there the possibility that there are non-drug dealers that would be familiar and understand that? Yes.
I mean, people who live in the neighborhoods where these things take place.
There is the possibility that individuals living in certain neighborhoods may have heard those terms and come to understand them, even though themselves not at all involved in drug dealing. However, given the totality of the evidence, the fact that we called a witness in rebuttal who said he bought crack cocaine 5 times from the defendant, the district court was not required to agree with that and make that finding. The district court was entitled to credit the entirety of the evidence, including the testimony of the rebuttal witness, who said that he had personally purchased crack cocaine from the defendant on 5 occasions, and make that decision that this was not someone from a community that may have not been involved in drug dealing but may have had life experiences that led them to hear those terms and understand them. Instead, this was a drug dealer who was using drug code because he was talking on a telephone, and he didn't want to talk about crack cocaine on a telephone. He wanted to call it a Cadillac the hard way.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Barth. Anything further, Mr. Goldberger?
Two extremely quick points. First of all, my friend says there's no support in the record for our objection to the finding. What has to be on the record is support for the finding. The finding, as Judge Williams has suggested, seems to be based on a cultural assumption and not on fact. With respect to the claim that there is no authority for the proposition that a proper objection or a sequence of proper objections can give rise to a constitutional error, notwithstanding their correctness under evidence law, that's certainly not true. There's a whole line of Supreme Court cases cited in pages 2 to 3 of our reply brief of that kind, of which Rock versus Arkansas is the principal one that's most similar.
Getting back to the first point, was there any evidence introduced on behalf of the defense that this kind of language was just language that's generally known in the community or on CDs or on websites? So nothing was put in the record on that.
I don't think I said that there was in my brief, and I hope that if there was, I would have put it in my brief. I didn't go back and reread the whole sentencing transcript. I don't think it was, but it's readily noticeable from the government sources that I cited in the reply brief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.